Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. In the news this week, of course, is the capitulation of the PGA Golf Tournament selling out to Saudi Arabia. No, wait, that's golf. That's not important. Okay, how about the destruction of the dam in Ukraine that has flooded hundreds of thousands of acres and forced evacuations of hundreds of thousands of people and has destroyed entire towns? A Soviet-era hydroelectric dam on the Dnieper River that held one of the largest reservoirs in Europe was destroyed earlier this week, unleashing a torrent of water so great that the river's width downstream has increased in some places to more than 2 miles wide, flooding homes and critical farmland. It's generally believed to have been destroyed by explosives, although the nature of the alleged explosives and the critical question of who they might have belonged to remain unresolved. Ukraine, of course, blames Russia, saying that Russia did it to stall the planned Ukrainian military counteroffensive, which would have crossed the river via a number of bridges that are now washed out. Russia blames Ukraine, citing the destruction of the some critical Russian defense installations by the floodwaters. There are credible hypotheses that point fingers in both directions, but so far all anyone has is speculation and supposition. Both Russia and Ukraine had contingencies, apparently, for destroying the dam, and Ukraine had, in fact, shelled the dam a number of months earlier, causing some persistent leaks. The flooding is causing losses to both Russia and Ukraine, and the interruption in Ukraine's agricultural production will be felt around the world. I had not known this, but a large portion of Ukraine's agriculture takes place in regions where there actually isn't very much rainfall and is therefore dependent on irrigation, specifically from the Kakhovka Reservoir, which is so large that locals refer to it sometimes as an inland sea. Countries in Africa and Asia are dependent on Ukrainian grain exports, which will now be less plentiful and therefore more expensive. Just like the forest fires now burning in Canada, which have ruined air quality in much of the eastern U.S., no ecological disaster of that magnitude can happen on our tiny globe without it affecting much of the planet these days. We have several reports about the dam breach from various sources. I note that several news agencies, including Sky News and the BBC, initially reported that Russia was responsible, but are now saying that that is an unknown. We also have a brief news clip from the CBC and one from NBC about Canada's forests and the threats they face due to climate change, produced a few months before the present fires. We'll start with this report from Gravitas News, based in India, which has remained officially neutral in the Ukraine conflict.
When it rains, it pours. It's not raining in Ukraine yet, but there is water just about everywhere. Houses are flooded, streets are flooded, people are being forced to flee their land. What really happened? How did things reach this point? A dam was destroyed in Ukraine. Now, this is the Nova Kakhovka Dam. This is where it is on the map, in the Kherson region. Kakhovka is Ukraine's fifth largest dam. It dates back to the Soviet era. And this dam was built in the year 1956, to be specific. It is 30 meters tall, some 3.2 kilometers long. This dam provides water to South Ukraine, or at least it used to. What this dam also did was provide water to cool the reactors of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. And we have been telling you all about this nuclear power plant and how it is a security and an existential risk to not just Ukraine or Russia, but also to wider Europe. Time for the big question now. Who really destroyed this dam? Now, there are contradictory claims, much like everything else in this war, and we will get to that in a bit. First, let's just try and understand what you see on your screen. What do these images really mean? In a nutshell, they mean higher food prices, inflation. Even for you, You may be living thousands of miles away from this dam, but its debt will end up bleeding your pockets. Ukraine, remember, is among the world's top five grain suppliers. It supplies wheat to countries as far as Bangladesh, Pakistan, Malaysia, and Egypt. Sri Lanka imports maize from Ukraine, as does Israel, even China, Portugal, Libya, among others. India, for that matter, imports sunflower oil from Ukraine. So does Qatar, the UAE, Kenya, Taiwan. And the destruction of this dam is going to affect all of these countries and all the others dependent on Ukraine. Let me just remind you that Ukraine's agricultural fields account for 9% of the global wheat exports, 15% of maize, 44% of sunflower oil. So what happens to these food crops when there isn't enough water to irrigate them? They die. And then the supply chain collapses. And before you know it, there's the impact in your kitchens. You see, the destruction of this dam has triggered this domino effect. And it also stands to impact the production of 80% of vegetables and fruits in Ukraine, a lot of which, by the way, are exported to parts of Europe. And I'm talking about basics like tomatoes, eggplants, peppers, cucumbers, peaches, grapes. This dam would help irrigate their fields, and now, without this dam, growing this produce will be impossible. And why do I say that? Because the parts of Ukraine in which these fruits and vegetables are grown receives just about 400 millimeters of rain each year, which is not enough to farm. And what's worse, restoring this dam could take anything between 5 to 10 years. So essentially what we are staring at is yet another humanitarian disaster. And the question is this Russia blowing up yet another of Ukraine's critical infrastructure? Here's why else I use the word critical. This dam, like I mentioned earlier, provides water for cooling the nuclear reactors at the Zaporizhia power plant. The power plant still contains tens of thousands of kilograms of radioactive material. In case the cooling process stops, the nuclear fuel will start melting, which will then create high pressure, resulting in an explosion. And what happens following an explosion? A nuclear leak. The explosion will give rise to invisible radioactive clouds. They could travel anywhere depending on the weather. Those in the path will suffer from radiation poisoning and be at risk of developing cancer. The UN's nuclear watchdog is bracing for the worst-case scenario. The International Atomic Agency, Atomic Energy Agency, or the IAEA, has sent out a message to Ukraine and Russia asking the two sides to spare Zaporizhia's cooling pond. The IAEA wants to ensure that the pond has enough water to cool the nuclear reactors for at least some months. And this pond, by the way, is located very close to the now broken dam. Currently, this pond is full. But how long will it remain that way? That is hard to say at this point. The flooding that resulted from the dam's destruction puts at risk some 16,000 odd people. 8 settlements in the region are already flooded. Ukraine wants the dam destruction to be investigated as a war crime, even ecocide. What's that? Well, Article 441 of Ukraine's criminal code defines ecocide as mass destruction of flora and fauna, poisoning of air or water resources, and also any other action that may cause environmental disasters. But how can we be sure Ukraine did not stage this sabotage? Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is pointing the finger at quote-unquote Russian terrorists. Kiev says Russia blew up the dam so that Ukraine's forces cannot cross the Dnipro River. Let me just read out at this point what Ukraine's intelligence agency has said exactly. The occupiers blew up the dam off the reservoir in a panic. This is an obvious act of terrorism and a war crime, which will be evidenced in an international tribunal. And this message was shared on Telegram. Basically, Kiev is saying Russia's plan was to widen the river. And like we have been telling you, the eastern side of the Dnipro is more or less under complete Russian control. But here's the other side of the story. Why would Russia blow up the dam? While the widening of the river will surely be a hurdle for the Ukrainian forces, but it will not be any different for the Russians. That's unless they are content with their gains and plan to not advance further. That said, destruction of the dam also means water supply issues for Crimea and other regions upstream of the Dnipro. Did Russia think it will get away with this crisis? What is Russia saying? Well, Moscow claims Ukraine blew up the dam with Storm Shadow missiles, the same ones that Britain sent. The Russia-installed mayor of Kherson, Vladimir Saldo, claims Kiev is trying to distract the world from its quote-unquote failures of the counter-offensive. What failures? Asked the Wagner boss. Remember Yevgeny Prigozhin? Well, he has been missing from TV screens since handing over Bakhmut to the Russian forces. And today, he made headlines once again with yet another attack on Russia's defense ministry. Well, the Wagner boss says Russia's claims of thwarting Ukraine's counteroffensive are nothing but, quote-unquote, wild fantasies. That's right. He said, and I'm quoting, to destroy 1,500 people, it must be such a massacre. Within one day, over 150 kilometers. One hell of a massacre. Therefore, I think that these are just some wild fantasies. Is Wagner a liar or has he exposed the truth to power? We will, of course, tell you once we have an answer.
Now, this moment as we speak, there are thousands of people who are being evacuated from their settlements along the southern stretch of Ukraine's Dnipro River. Water from the breached Novokakhovka Dam has resulted in at least about 16,000 people being in the critical zone for flooding. It has resulted in several streets and town squares getting flooded. The collapse of the barrier at the southern tip of the vast reservoir has unleashed a torrent, adding to misery for the thousands of people who've been caught on the front lines of war between Russia and Ukraine. Looking downstream, Russia, remember, controls the left bank of the Dnipro River and the dam itself, while Ukraine, interestingly, holds the right bank, and each side has blamed the other for causing the damage that has triggered the latest crisis in this conflict. Now, Ukraine has accused Russia of deliberately blowing it up. But the question is this: why would Russia want to blow up a dam on a territory that it presently controls? Now, Moscow may have feared, it is being reported, that Ukrainian forces would have used the road over the dam in its counter-offensive. Russia has called this as an act of sabotage by Ukraine. Kremlin says that the sabotage will deprive the Crimean Peninsula of water. And apart from sustaining thousands of people, the dam also provided cooling water for the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. The power plant, which is hundreds of miles downstream, is currently under Russian control again. Now, flooding has long been used in warfare, although its effectiveness has been debatable. Now, hydraulic warfare has resulted in the past in a huge humanitarian cost wherever it has been employed. So let's tell you about the incidents in the past where flooding has been used as a weapon of war. The Chinese nationalists used flooding on a massive scale in their war against the Japanese in 1938. The Kuomintang troops unstopped a series of dikes along the Yellow River to stop the invading Japanese forces. This had unleashed a massive water surge that engulfed three of China's provinces. At least about a million Chinese civilians reportedly drowned in the torrent, while more than 12 million people were displaced. 5 years later, the British Royal Air Force used bombing of dams as a strategy against the Germans. In May 1943, the RAF, the Royal Air Force, had struck a pair of hydroelectric dams on the Ruhr River. The raids had knocked out power along the river valley, briefly disrupting the German wartime production, and it caused widespread flooding. The warfighters had swept away more than 1,500 people back then. Now, at the end of the last century, Saddam Hussein in 1993 had diverted the Tigris and the Euphrates away from the vast wetland in southern Iraq. The Iraqi dictator had ordered the military engineers to drain the Mesopotamian marshes in order to deny the Shia insurgents sanctuary there. It had impacted an estimated 100,000 people at the time. And to give us more perspective in terms of what has resulted in the breach of the Novakhachkovka Dam today, earlier this morning, we're being joined by Mr. Charles Kupchan, who's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and also a professor of international affairs at Georgetown University. So thank you very much indeed for taking time out and speaking to us here on Beyond. Let me begin by asking you this. You know, any time an incident such as this happens, the first question that needs to be asked is cui bono? Who gains out of this? What do you make of the accusations and counter-accusations that have been levelled about the breaching of the Novakhachkovka Dam? And more importantly, who gains out of this?
Well, the Ukrainians are claiming the Russians did it. The Russians are claiming the Ukrainians did it. We don't yet have a clear sign, clear evidence. But it would be very surprising to me if this were an attack carried out by the Ukrainians. Why? Because they're flooding their own citizens. They're distracting themselves from the offensive they are about to begin. Mm-hmm. So it looks pretty clear to me that this is something that was carried out by Russia. Right. Why would Russia do this? Two reasons. One, to try to distract Kyiv from focusing on the offensive. Number two, to widen the river, the southern part of the Dnipro, to make it harder for Ukrainian forces that are on the east, the west bank, to get to the east bank and to start going through and against the defenses that Russia has built. So there is a strategic rationale here.
All right, very interesting. But also, you know, considering the fact is to have pieces of infrastructure, you know, a dam you'd not normally believe is something that the warring factions would touch. But this is a clear breach of a dam that has happened. But the Russians have argued that this is something that the Ukrainians have done because they want to divert their forces who are being held up at Kherson further north. What do you make of the Russian allegation?
You know, there is a story to be told that Ukraine might have interest in blowing up the dam to somehow distract the Russians, to flood some of those areas that the Russians are holding. I think it's a stretch. Countries do not bomb their own dams and threaten their own citizens. If there is a clear strategic advantage here, it is to the Russians, because right, it will hamper the coming offensive by the Ukrainian military to cross the Dnipro and to push into what we call the land bridge that connects Crimea to Donbas. Given that strategic rationale, pretty clear to me that the likely perpetrator here is Moscow.
Very interesting. Now, the Russians, of course, would turn around and say that this was a dam that also provided water to the Crimean Peninsula. This was also the dam that provided the water to cool the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, which is presently under the control of the Russians. And therefore, the Russians would say that Ukraine has got a lot of things to gain out of blowing up this dam. Do you think there is merit in this argument?
Well, as far as we know, the Zaporizhia power plant will still get the water that it needs to cool the reactors, which have effectively been shut down. Yes, Crimea is dependent on water from the Dnipro flowing through a canal, and as a consequence, they need that water. Is this a sufficient rationale for the Ukrainians to blow up the dam? No, because they could find other ways to shut down that canal and to hamper Russian operations and quality of life in right, Crimea. So the rationale really doesn't make a lot of sense here in all terms right, of why Ukraine would carry out this attack.
All right. Thank you very much indeed, Professor Kupchan, for joining us and getting us all those details there on this very big story that we'll continue to track here on Beyond.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky visited the area flooded by a major dam that collapsed in South Ukraine this week. The flood left five residents in the Novakhachkova region dead, according to reports. Officials say that more than 6,000 people have been evacuated from cities, towns, and villages on both the Ukrainian and Russian-controlled sides of the Dnipro River, which the dam has emptied its reservoir onto. Now, the destruction of the Khachkova Dam led to flooded villages in danger crops, threatened supplies of drinking water. Ukraine and Russia have both blamed each other for the destruction.
Meanwhile, Ukrainian forces have suffered losses in heavy equipment and soldiers as they met greater than expected resistance from Russian forces in first attempt to breach Russian lines in the east in recent days. That's according to two senior U.S. officials who told CNN's Jim Sciutto. Senior fellow and military expert at Defense Priorities, Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis, joins us now to discuss. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you make of what's happening with Ukraine's offensive, which I guess in the greater context of things could be the defensive? But what's complicated now by the impact of the flooding and the greater than expected resistance from Russia?
Yeah, we'll take the bridge issue first. Both Moscow and Kiev immediately seized on that once it became clear that what had happened, violently accused the other of terrorist attacks, et cetera. But I think when you look at the preponderance of evidence, the most likely cause of this is actually the weakening of the bridge from the HIMARS attack by the Ukrainian side last November. Actually, they damaged it when it was still under full Russian control, and Russia was actually on that side of the river, and then they withdrew in November. The thing has been leaking for months, and it appears that it just finally gave way and broke the top of it. Actually, the superstructure underneath is actually still intact, and things could get worse if that goes out too. But the reason I say that is because you see that the military units on both sides of the river were not, neither side was prepared for this, and they both have been scrambling to get out of the way. So that means that no one knew it was coming. And I think they're both just trying to take advantage of it in the information sphere to their advantage.
So
now,
yours,
it is having.
Go
I'm
ahead.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
It is having an impact, though, on the offensive or on the process of the war, because it washed away a lot of mines on the Russian side and also their defensive positions. They've had to relocate backwards, but it's complicated the Ukrainian side, because now then they can't launch some of these cross river operations over the Dnieper that they had potentially planned, because now then the far shore has been expanded and now turned into a morass. So they can't land there now potentially for many weeks to come. So it's basically taken the southern part of that fight off the table for the time being, and put all the focus then on the next part around the Zaporizhia area, where now, as you pointed out, the offensive seems to have been kicked off.
So you are saying that a previous engagement, a previous effort in the war on the Ukrainian side is what damaged the dam. So unlikely, you're saying, if you're looking at the evidence, to be that it was deliberately either Ukraine or Russia engaging this sabotage, but the result of previous efforts by the Ukrainians. And does that just kind of show, you know, the dangers of this conflict going on and on and on, where there will be damage, there will be loss of life, there will be destruction that wasn't even intended by either side, just as a consequence of this horrific war continuing to unfold?
Oh, without question it is. And in fact, one of the secondary problems that's going to come down the line here for God only knows how long is that because of all these minefields that the Russian side had, and probably the Ukraine side too, as far as we know, because now that they've just been washed away, there's no telling where those mines are going to end up. They could be in the middle of streets. They could be in the middle of fields. It could be years before people just stumble on them. But now that they don't even know where they're at, and almost certainly that's going to be stumbled upon by people probably for years to come. And this is just going to continue on even after the war is over.
That is, that's truly, truly horrifying. Colonel, you wrote in a recent op-ed for Newsweek that Ukraine must not be allowed to join NATO. Can you expand on the argument you made there?
Yeah, look, it doesn't matter how this thing ends, whether negotiated settlement here or an outright victory by either side. And of course, that really means the Russian side. Under no circumstances is it in American interest, or even European interest for that matter, to give binding military security guarantees to Ukraine. Because, look, this whole war here was at a minimum 15 direct years in the making before it happened here. And the animosity now between the Ukrainians and the Russians has just, you know, risen off the charts and is not going away for a generation. Even after this thing is over, it's entirely possible that the war could start again by either side. And the United States has no interest in being on the hook to potentially go fight a war with Russia if that sparks back again. So armed neutrality for Ukraine is fair game. They should be free with whatever comes out of a negotiated settlement to have their own national security, to arm themselves however they want to be. But it is no way that the Americans should provide any kind of security guarantees, whether individually or through NATO.
And what do you make of what the Ukrainian people want? It's my understanding that for a long time there was a desire to be a part of Europe geopolitically, culturally. And the war has really shifted this kind of sentiment, especially among citizens in Ukraine who now really feel this identity. We are Ukrainian. We are not Europeans. We are embracing our culture as a part of their defense against an invasion. That's really what sparked this kind of sentiment among the citizens. Does Ukraine still strongly want to join NATO and the rest of Europe?
Well, it depends on which part of Ukraine you're talking about, because look, the reality is that in the 8 years prior to this war, there was a civil war being fought flat out between the east and west of the Ukraine. And those divisions have only increased in hatred of one another and in division. And doesn't matter how this war is ever negotiated to an end, that's not going to heal. Those wounds, the emotional wounds, won't heal for a generation or more. And so the people on the Western side, many of them absolutely want to join NATO because they view that as the only security guarantee against a much larger Russian neighbor. And then the other side of the Ukraine, of course, they want nothing to do with NATO or anything else. They want protection from Moscow. So it depends on where you are in Ukraine as to what they want. So there is no unified Ukraine is the bottom line.
Before we let you go, want to get your take on recent news we've been hearing with respect to Nord Stream. There was a reporting in the Washington Post just the other day about a report obtained by the Washington Post saying that U.S. intelligence officials were warned that there was going to be a Ukrainian attack on Nord Stream. So there's a lot of possibilities now, but more, I think, acknowledgement in the mainstream media that a culprit, that the U.S., Ukraine, something of that nature is likely what had to do with Nord Stream. What are you making of the potential options? Because I guess one reading I have now of the Washington Post report is that perhaps the Ukrainians went ahead and did it on their own. Maybe they did it with U.S. involvement. How has your thinking been affected by the recent news?
You know, Robbie, I tell you, I've come to really question anything I hear in the public from either Washington, Kiev, London, because there's so much misinformation and so many things turn out later to be untrue. I think that there's at least a good probability. We can't know for sure. All we know is what's being reported. But I think that there's a good chance that this is basically trying to excuse the United States away from having done this. All the things in the Hirsch report, I think, are the most plausible because they match what actually happened here. And even at the time that came out, a lot of people claimed, oh, well, this was, potentially some rogue element that did this. And I think this is more, justification from the United States that, yeah, that's what happened. But I'm pretty skeptical. I'll put it that way.
Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis, thank you so much for breaking this down with us. We've got more Rising.
Always
after
my
this.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The war on the Ukrainian front following the Russian invasion of Ukraine has seemed to be stalemated now for several months. And that is the reason we haven't talked about it very much, because when a war gets stalemated, I know it's a terrible thing to say, when people are lobbing shells at each other or carrying out little actions here and there, it does still cause enormous amount of human misery and damage. But it doesn't become a story. So what do we talk about? That war has now had one major event. I will not say it's a turning point in the war in the sense of one side getting an upper hand over the other, but it's a turning point only to the extent that something unprecedented in the history of modern warfare has happened. That is a major dam, a hydroelectric dam in this case, with a huge reservoir of water, has been either blown up from inside or blown up from outside, we don't know. But definitely, this dam has been destroyed. This is the Nova Kakhovka Dam. The dam is very big. I will tell you something more about the dam, and there will be debates about who has taken it down. That means, was it blown up from inside, which means explosives or huge explosive charges were placed underneath it. It's a large dam. It will not It can't be blown up with a normal IED or a hand grenade or a bunch of grenades. It needs a humongous charge. It was a dam built to survive a nuclear attack from the top, remember. So whatever has happened had to happen, at least technically, from lower down, from within, from deep down. Deep down, a big explosion, then boom, takes the dam out. Now, blowing up a dam in wartime, what happens? Is it a legitimate target in war? No, it is not a legitimate target. So while we will keep on debating who was responsible, who destroyed the dam, and Russians will blame the Ukrainians, and Ukrainians will blame the Russians, and the friends of Ukrainians will blame the Russians also, that is most of the Western world. I don't know how many friends of the Russians, there aren't that many, will speak up, and those that seem sort of neutral, that is China, which is quite neutral, India, which is at least vocally or verbally neutral. In terms of substance, it is not that neutral, right? But at the same, because India is a member of the Quad, and Quad has included in one of its joint statements a para which is very similar to United Nations resolutions asking Russia to vacate from Ukraine, using pretty much the same language without naming anybody. So I will not say India is neutral, but reasonably neutral. So these countries will not speak up on behalf of Russia and blame Ukraine. But if you see the media, media that we read most of all, that is the so-called quote-unquote Western media, right? That is also seen as pro-Ukraine. In that, you see a lot of evidence and suggestion that this has been done by the Russians. At the same time, if you go to social media, to Telegram channels, which have been giving us videos and news on this war, and the Russians are very active there, Russian state, Russian disinformation machinery, and also Russian information machinery. That's legitimate. They are all very active there. They would suggest that the Ukrainians have done it. So first of all, I'll tell you about the laws of war and why this is not a legitimate target in any war. So whoever has done it is guilty of a major war crime. Once again, we are not sitting in judgment over who's done it because we don't know yet. I don't think the rest of the world knows yet also. And in these situations, I'm not even sure this will ever come out. Unlike the Nord Stream gas pipeline sabotage, because that was a gas pipeline sabotage, and the Western media itself reported, it was the American media that reported that this was carried out by Ukrainians, a small bunch of Ukrainians in an underwater boat, say about 6 or 8 Ukrainians. You can blow up a gas pipeline like that, something like that happened. But on this one, it'll be tough. Nevertheless, let me tell you, what does international law say on this? And I've picked it up from Igor Sushko, who's a Ukrainian American, so he has a point of view which will be pro-Ukrainian. So on his tweet, he says Russia blowing up the dam is going to have severe consequences. The act equates to the use of weapons of mass destruction under international law. So I will distance myself from his insinuation or his allegation that the Russians have blown up this dam. If you take that aside, which I'm taking it aside because I don't know and we don't know, so we will not jump to conclusions, and we have no dog in the race, right? We are not on this side or that side. There's a war going on. Hopefully the war will be over, and anybody's territory that's been invaded or anybody's sovereignty that's been violated will eventually be restored. That is what you might say about the war, but no sides. And he goes on to say that dams like the Dnipro Dam in Nova Kakhovka are protected by the laws of war and the Geneva Convention. Destroying it would be considered a weapon of mass destruction and an indiscriminate war crime. Article 56 of the 1977 additional protocol to Geneva Conventions provides as follows. And now I'm quoting from the Article 56 of the additional protocol of Geneva Conventions as inserted in 1977. And this protocol, this para says, I'll read the entire para to you. It says, and I quote from the convention, works and installations containing dangerous forces, namely dams, dikes and nuclear electrical generating stations, shall not be made the object of attack, even where these objects are military objectives. If such attack may cause the release of dangerous forces and consequent severe losses among the civilian population, other military objectives located at or in the vicinity of these works or installations shall not be made the subject of attack. If such attack may cause the release of dangerous forces from the works or installations and consequent severe losses among the civilian population. Now see what has happened. And you will see the pictures also of this destruction of this dam or the consequences of the destruction of this dam. So first of all, it has released a dangerous force, which is enormous amounts of this water is flowing. This dam, the storage area, by the way, this is among the largest dams in the world, among the largest storage areas in the world. In fact, it has more storage than any dam in India. And you can count the biggest ones in India, Teri Dam, Bhakra Dam, Nagarjuna Sagar. Those are the big dams in India with a lot of storage. This dam has more storage because European rivers are big. They are big enough for ship-sized vessels to ply into them. Also, the Dnipro is the fourth longest river in Europe. It is 2,200 kilometers, of which about 921 kilometers flows through Ukraine. So Dnipro begins near Smolensk in Russia. You can see it on the map, goes into Belarus, and then comes sort of meanders and comes into Ukraine, and then divides Ukraine into two halves, the eastern half and the western half. The eastern half by now is mostly occupied the Russian forces. The western half, or more than the western half, that is the bulk of Ukrainian territory, about say 15-17% on the eastern side, 15-17% of the entire Ukrainian territory, that's occupied by the Russians. Whereas the rest on the western side is with Ukraine. This river is the dividing line between the two battling forces. Now, in any warfare, it can be a mountain, it can be a mountain ridge, a river, a canal. That usually becomes the dividing line. So this has become the dividing line. It's well known that Ukraine has been planning a big counteroffensive at the Russian occupying forces. And that counteroffensive ultimately has to be launched across the river. So this is the river that is now gorging out this enormous amounts of water. In fact, if I see the Russian accounts, then in the Russian townships adjoining this dam, just after this dam, water levels have gone up from anything from 7.5 meters, that is about 25 feet, to 15 meters. 15 meters is enough to drown an entire city. 15 meters is more than 50 feet. That can drown an entire city, and the water is coming out. It's a reservoir spanning a land size spanning 2,155 square kilometers. It is that big. You want to see how other reservoirs are? Teri Dam, which has a lot of water, it's one of India's biggest dam, is 52 kilometers square. This is 2,155 kilometers square. Maybe not all of it is so deep, maybe some of it is shallow, but it's a lot of water. And that water level is now going down at the rate of 15 centimeters per hour. So you can see with such an expanse of water, if the level is going down by 15 centimeters per hour, how much water is flowing down. Now, 30 kilometers downstream of this dam is also the city of Kherson, critical city of Kherson, which was the Russian forces' only foothold on the west bank of the Dnieper River. And they had occupied it for nearly 8 months. That's when, in a series of bold counterattacks from three sides, Ukrainians were able to liberate it. We had, in fact, done an entire episode of Cutta Clutter on this. That was number 1111. I am sharing a link with you. Please take a look. Now, that city now gets flooded. So, which means, if this isn't mine, you won't have it too. So, that's one way of looking at it, right? Maybe somebody wants to just, out of spite, do this. Maybe somebody is also concerned that Ukrainians are now starting their counter-offensive. And if you read the Western media, there is some indication that something had started on Sunday already. So this is a way of blocking that counter-offensive. Because if the land on which your heavy forces were to move for counter-offensive, if those have all been flooded now, then how do you stage that counter-offensive? You then have to wait. And you might have to wait for a very long time. So those are things that are being said by the Ukrainian side or Ukraine supporters to argue that the Russians took to gain more from this. But there is a lot of analysis. I see, for example, an article. There's one explanation on why it may hurt the Ukrainians more. It says, in the near term, it's hurting the Ukrainian more, said Mark Kanshian, a retired Marine officer and defense expert with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS. And it may hurt them more because, one, it slows down or it blocks their counteroffensive. And second, because it floods a lot of Ukraine's cropping areas. That is where Ukraine's main export to the world is food grain, mostly wheat, and sunflower seeds. Now, if these areas are flooded, that is like using food as an act of war. That is the allegation from that side, and that's where it hurts Ukraine more in the short run. In the long run, however, the same article tells us it hurts Russia more. And why? It says the damage to the Russian-controlled dam would make it difficult for the Ukrainian troops to cross into Crimea and other Russian-occupied cities in the south. On the other hand, it could eventually cut water off from Crimea and other parts of Russian-held territory. Flooding the region could also affect Russian defenses and supply routes. So Russian defenses, the frontline Russian defenses on the eastern bank of the river have all got flooded. So Russian units are also having to withdraw from there because nobody likes to live in flooded trenches and bunkers. At the same time, Crimea, which is the prize and which is what the Russians occupied in 2014, sort of becoming a kind of causes belli, which still continues. That gets its water supply from Dnieper River. That water supply comes through a canal. It's an old canal called the North Crimean Canal. That is the canal to which the Ukrainians had stopped water supply after the Russians occupied it. And then the Russians moved ahead finally and they opened supplies to it. Once again now, if this water is wasted, there'll be no water left to go into this canal. Now, the Russians are saying that they will not have a drinking water shortage in Crimea because the canal is still holding enough water and they can ration it for some time. But the fact is, it will be a big stress for them. So this will be quite damaging to them as well. Once again, come back to the war crime aspect of it, no matter who's done it. Now, this para in Article 56 of the Additional Protocol of Geneva Conventions also says work and installations containing dangerous forces, namely dams, dikes and nuclear electrical generating stations. So I told you earlier, this affects a large civilian population. So to that extent, it fulfills the criteria of being a war crime under this clause. Also, remember that this dam reservoir, because it's such a humongous reservoir, the biggest nuclear plant in Europe, that is the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, that is 5.7 gigawatt. It's a humongous nuclear power plant. The cooling for that power plant is provided by the waters of the reservoir of the Nova Kakhovka dam. So the management of the nuclear power plant says that right now there isn't that much concern. International Atomic Energy Authority, the regulator, they've also said, the watchdog, they've also said that right now we don't see a threat, but ultimately this water will run out because once a dam is broken, you can't fix a dam for years. It's a dam built in 1956. It's a dam filled with soil, a little bit of rock, also has a core of clay, right? So once a dam like this goes away, you can't just use engineering to build it. Look at the size of the dam. The dam is not very tall. These are not Himalayan dams. Indian dams tend to be very tall, only 30 meters tall. But look at how wide it is. It is 3,273 meters. That is almost 3.3 kilometers wide. A dam like that goes away, you can't just build it in no time. That means the loss of this water will carry on for a long time. And how much water it is? This reservoir holds 15 million acre feet of water. You want to see it on another scale? It's very difficult for me to calculate and tell you what is what. It will be 18 cubic kilometers of water. It's a lot of water. Suffice it to see it as maybe more than twice as much water as Bhakra Nangal. If you look at the listing of the 50 biggest dam reservoirs in the world, Nova Kakhovka comes at 48, right? So it's not among the biggest 10 or 15. Those are, first one is in Zimbabwe, then America, Canada, Russia. There are lots of them. It is the 48th. And remember, in the first 50, no Indian dam even features. No Terry, no Bhakra, no Nagarjuna Sagar. That is for the amount of water it holds. So it still holds among the largest bodies of water in the world. Now, both sides will continue blaming each other. Russians are saying that this is Ukrainian sabotage. Ukrainians are saying the terrorist Russians have done it. Videos have surfaced on Telegram channels and elsewhere that show a big explosion that's taken place from within the dam. That means charges were placed under the dam. Zelensky in October in a speech had said that the Russian forces have placed charges under the dam and they will blow it up anytime. Now, the fact is that the dam has been under Russian occupation from very early days of the war because they took the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant and then they took the dam also. So it's been with them. At the same time, it's widely believed that Ukrainians earlier carried out the destruction or the damage to that Nord Stream gas pipeline. So once again, in such a messy situation, nobody quite knows what is happening. But one very curious thing has surfaced. And this is again from an Ukrainian origin journalist, but working for Politico Europe. And she's Nika Melkozirova. And the reason I'm quoting this is because there is a document attached to it. And we've checked out the document. It looks authentic. And I'm sharing also screenshots of the document with you in your screen. So she says that on May 31, Russian government passed a special legislation barring investigation at hazardous production facilities and accidents of hydraulic structures occurring due to hostilities and sabotage until 2028. So May 31, they passed a law that said if there is any sabotage or destruction at any hydraulic plants, etc., it cannot be investigated until 2028. Now, why would they do it? And that too, 5 days before this happens. Now, one interpretation would be that they were going to do it. So they were covering their officials from any questioning later on. But the other is, do you think the Russians are so stupid that if they are planning to do this, then they will also pass a law at the same time accordingly? So they'll be seen as usual suspects. So we don't know. So what you see on your screen first is that particular para in the resolution in Russian. The whole resolution will run through your screen as we talk. We've got the whole document translated, obviously, by using internet. We don't know Russian. But I will read one key para to you. And this is para 10 on page 4. It says, until January 1, 2028, technical investigation of accidents at hazardous production facilities and accidents of hydraulic structures that occurred as a result of military operations, sabotage and terrorist act is not carried out. So, did the Russians mean to cover their officials from any future action and thereby pass this law in a hurry? Or the second thing is, if they knew they were going to carry out this action, would they be so dumb as to pass this law at that time? We don't know. What we know, however, is that this is a great human tragedy. It's a tragedy not just for humans, but also for animals, particularly for animals who are so dear to humans, say pets, for example. So I'm sharing with you this video in the end to conclude this episode of Cut the Clutter, which is a video shared by Zelensky on Twitter. So once again, war is a bad thing, and destruction of big infrastructure projects, destruction of big civilian facilities in warfare is a war crime. Who's done it? We don't know as yet.
That was several reports from outside the U.S. on the destruction, perhaps by bombing, of the Kakhovka Dam in Russian-occupied Ukraine. We still don't know for certain who was responsible for this catastrophe. We do know that at least some of the forest fires now sweeping through Canada's forest were caused by lightning, and others apparently by arson. But the underlying conditions that have contributed to the scale of these fires are a more global responsibility, as you'll hear in the following two reports.
Canada is home to the world's largest relatively untouched forest. The boreal zone is home to Earth's coldest forest and stretches across Canada and around the globe, covering 1.9 billion hectares globally. And the boreal forest is important.
It not only serves as a huge carbon store, but at thriving ecosystems for plants and animals, including over 100 species of birds, mammals like moose and caribou, and 3.7 million people.
Between wildfire, weather, and other factors, the boreal forest is constantly changing, but climate change is bringing a new level of transformation.
If we think about drought, if we think about fire, if we think about insects, disease. This large tract of forest is contending with all of these environmental threats all the time. But under climate change, at least some of these threats are more severe.
So what can we expect in Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba? Well, it largely depends on water.
As our climate changes, we can expect milder winters and hotter summers. And the rain we get in the summer may not be enough to compensate for the water loss to evaporation and transpiration. That means a higher risk of drought and wildfire. And those drier conditions have a big impact on the boreal forest.
When trees are faced with a lack of water, that's pretty serious, right? Those trees are adapted to holding out. They close their pores on their leaves to try to prevent water from escaping. But if they do that, they're not gaining sugars from photosynthesis. So they're not gaining the resources they need to grow. And so if we have year over year over year of drought, they're not gaining the resources they need to thrive.
Experts say that water stress could make boreal forests across southern Alberta and Saskatchewan more vulnerable to pathogens, wildfire, and even pests. With more extensive wildfires and more severe outbreaks from insects like mountain pine beetles, the forests could lose their ability to regenerate.
So what does that mean for our forests' future?
There's kind of been emerging evidence that as the climate continues to warm, that the boreal biome might shift northward. And so this would include an expansion of boreal trees and shrubs into Arctic and Alpine tundra in the coldest margins of the boreal forest, as well as potentially a contraction of the forest along the southern margins.
With growth to the north and recession to the south, the future health and size of the boreal forest system will come down to a matter of balance and timing.
There's just a lot of dynamic change, and it's going to take a while for things to kind of settle into any kind of equilibrium. So if you lose an older forest here in the south, you don't really have the opportunity to make that up really very soon. So that means a lot of species that are depending on older mature forest, especially coniferous forest in particular, there's just less of that habitat going to be available in the short term.
So with all of this being said, is it too late to save our boreal forests? Well, some of the changes we're seeing may be inevitable at this point. We can still have an impact.
Of course, lowering greenhouse gas emissions is key, but we can also work to protect our boreal forests, especially those that have the best chances of lasting, those with plenty of local water sources and more sheltered topography.
Was it ever too late to do something better? I would say no. I'm a little bit of an optimist that way. We can always try to do a little bit better and hope that that's going to have an effect, but we can never wind back the clock.
This is insane. Downtown talent right here.
2020 is on track to become one of the worst fire seasons on record.
We had to run and get in the truck and go. I'm 55 years old and I've never been homeless.
Over the last several decades, annual wildfires have become bigger and harder to contain.
My community is on fire, and we're here to protect our community, but we can only do so much. Sometimes it felt very like we weren't able to do anything. It was futile.
So what's changed that's made fires so much worse? And what can we do to fix it?
Over the last 24 hours, Oregon has experienced unprecedented fire.
Fires across Washington, Oregon, and California are setting records for some of the largest fires we've ever seen, burning millions of acres of land.
I have never woken up with smoke 3 out of the last 5 years choking my grandchildren. I've never seen ash in our cars before.
The area that was burned this year has broken records. Currently, 3 of the top 5 largest wildfires on record in California are all burning right now.
Last year, this time, this date, we had 5,136 fires, only burning 152,000 acres. Again, this year, 3.4 million acres, close to 8,000 fires.
Large fires have occurred throughout history.
There were similar ones in the late 1800s, the early 1900s, also driven by these major east wind events and drought conditions.
But their frequency and the amount of damage they do has steadily increased over the last several decades. Experts say a combination of things have increased our fire risk over time, and forest management could be one of the major factors.
Fire has been a part of these landscapes for as long as many of the species that we know and love in these forests have been there, and is part of the cycle of these forests and how they operate.
Wildfires are actually essential to the health of forests. Naturally occurring fires help clear out dead and diseased plants and promote biodiversity in the ecosystem.
Many trees have evolved to be very fire resistant. For example, redwood trees have very thick bark that's kind of spongy, and it makes them very resistant to wildfires. It's also important for things like the dispersal of seeds from pine cones. And so a healthy forest is one that experiences some level of wildfire and burning periodically.
Fire mitigation efforts in the U.S. have helped keep many man-made fires from spreading out of control. It's made it easier to develop communities that are not constantly in danger.
Smokey the Bear was one of the most successful ad campaigns in history, right? Only you can prevent forest fires. Fire suppression is very much a human construction. In order to keep fire out of our communities and to protect people and where we live.
But it's also prevented these low-level natural fires from occurring frequently, which can make fires much worse when they do happen.
When these fires burn, because there's been a buildup of vegetation, because we've taken fire out of the equation, then they do burn more severely, and it can take a long time to recover.
And so now when fires do occur, they can potentially be much more severe than they would have been historically, when frequent fires would have been coming through and removing a lot of that fuel every time a fire would come through every few years to decades.
Additional factors like high wind, lack of rain, and ignitions from urban development greatly increase fire risk, especially in western states with drier forests. But climate change has been a driving force in fueling these fires.
Research has shown that since about the 1970s or 1980s, climate change has caused the area of wildfires that burns in the western U.S. to double.
Temperatures in the southwest, where many large fires occur, have steadily increased, with many areas reaching 98 degrees regularly during the summer, and some areas reaching as high as 130, severely reducing snowpack and other water resources.
As the climate warms and as the conditions become warmer and drier, we are increasing the probability of fire to occur in a lot of these locations.
It's basically drying out the conditions on the land so that when you do get an ignition, a fire start, whether that be from fireworks or lightning or whatever the cause, these fires can really take off because the vegetation is dry.
While smaller controlled fires may help forests, the damage caused by these large fires can decimate them, and climate change reduces their chance of recovery.
In some systems, it can recover quickly, 20 years or so. In other areas, it can take hundreds of years. And in some areas, the reality is with climate change, it's possible we may not get forests back because the forests that started growing there 200 years ago, they started growing under a very different climate than we have now.
Taking a more aggressive approach to vegetation management might be able to help lower the risk of widespread wildfires. Officials have recommended prescribed controlled fires that can help clear out fuel buildup.
We do need to think about more prescribed burns in the southwest U.S., which is something that's been done in the southeast region of the U.S. for a long time with great success.
It's finding a balance, and unfortunately, I think over the last 80 years or so, the pendulum definitely swung more towards fire suppression, and now we're trying to bring prescribed fire back, but that's challenging.
But forest management measures alone are probably not enough to fix these problems.
Climate change is expected to continue to cause our wildfire seasons to be longer and more intense. We need to be working our hardest to try to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions so that we prevent these fires from growing even more extensive in the future.
The forests are going to be changing. The pace of that change is really what has a lot of us concerned right now in terms of how resilient these forests are going to be.
I think in recognizing that it is lots of different causes that can actually lead to solutions because it gives us lots of different things that we can address.
That's it for this week's Conscious Voices. Just a reminder, CompFest is coming up here in a couple of weeks, and we need volunteers for cleanup and security shifts. It'll benefit this station if you sign up and attribute your shift to WCRS or WGRN, both of which will be sharing a table there as well. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll see you all there as well as here next week for another edition. Take care. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM. WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.